This week on the show, the production world goes tapeless, IMAX goes digital, TV goes boom, and Ziff Davis goes bust. Right here on This Week in Media, number 85. Hey, everybody. We're back. We're back again. Back into an old... It's going to get old if I start talking about being old when we talk about episode 85, right? You know, because it just keeps on getting worse after that. So
well, we missed the obvious joke with episode 64.
Yes.
With that song.
Yes. Yes, we didn't use the song. Now we're in the same room. We're all in the same room again. We're trying to deal with some Skype issues, and so we just said, you know what, we're going to do it all locally again. So we've got John Foster, as you may have guessed.
You know what's different about today?
What's different?
We're sitting around the table from the Pixel Bar as if we're, you know, having
with
a
no drinks.
No drinks.
You know,
well,
next
I mean, there's
time.
Coffee, there's water, there's water, there's whatever's in that. That could be anything.
That's good earth. Good earth tea.
And cookies and chocolate.
Yeah, and cookies and chocolate.
Kirsten, who you can hear over there. Kirsten Sanford. Chocolate. Hey, Kirsten.
Hello.
Kirsten brought cookies and chocolate.
I did. I was buying vegetables and coffee, and I went, cookies and chocolate.
She started off healthy with vegetables.
Waka,
and then she went to the coffee, and then she ended up with the chocolate.
Exactly.
Next, we know that Kirsten will be bringing heroin.
You weren't going to make those jokes anymore.
Vegetables.
Oh, that's right.
Gateway food.
No drug jokes.
You're not sipping doll, are you, tonight?
No.
Marshall is here as well. Hey, Marshall.
Hello.
And we've got John, the other John.
Hey, Alex.
The John. They're both Johns. They're both John Fs. So we have to actually say John Flowers.
We're opposing each other. He's across the table over there.
Yes. We had to keep him apart.
Fiercely drinking my water, giving him the stink eye.
Evidently, they can't tell the difference between us. I don't know how that is.
I heard two people say that they couldn't tell the difference between our voices.
Just really?
That's so they got into a conversation, people would just get wildly confused.
They're like, wow, it's the same guy talking. He doesn't shut up.
He has a lot of ideas.
That's called schizophrenia.
So, me, myself, and
exactly.
I.
Exactly. Yeah, little do people know, John Flowers is a voice impersonation of John Foster.
Exactly.
Not real.
Exactly.
You notice you never hear both of us talking at once.
That's right, I'm drinking.
Da-da.
But it's close. Also, here we have Daisy. Daisy, Whitney.
Hello. And I think their voices are very different. I just want to weigh in with that.
I think that they are too. I mean, I don't know. Some people are, they're talking about it. And by the way, John was talking about the table. We have a new table here. We should probably take pictures of it somewhere. But we're slowly moving into this little studio. This used to be my office. It had nice, soft, cushy walls. So when I went nuts, I could just bounce off the walls and wouldn't hurt myself. Now we're slowly turning in. Joe's back there. Hey, Joe.
Hi.
Joe, who made a big deal about his microphone before the show.
Joe, yeah, and then he couldn't get it. There was so much buildup after I couldn't get to my tempo. I got so nervous.
That much.
I can feel my face turning beet red right now.
Yeah, it is.
Very red.
It's not that you look bullish or anything.
Right.
So Joe's doing engineering over there, and we've got all kinds of fun stories. Off the top, Microsoft licensed Adobe mobile software. What does this mean? What happened to Silverlight? Why aren't they using Silverlight? Why are they using Adobe?
Nobody's even been talking about Silverlight in my world. I've just got to jump in and say that. I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, it might be much more of like an underground, true engineer geek thing, but I just don't feel that anybody mainstream knows what it is.
I mean, it's one of those things that Microsoft still says that it's committed to. They said last month that they're going to give 1 billion students, this is according to the New York Times, 1 billion students free access to Silverlight. I thought that was...
We're going to give 1 billion students free access to software that they've probably pirated already. Just to check it out.
There are 1 billion students out there?
Exactly. I guess. I think that they said free access. And of those 1 billion, the question is how many will actually use it, and it'll probably be like 10.
Exactly. Yeah. And that 1 billion is to compete directly with Adobe Flash.
Yeah. Well, here's the question is this licensing them giving up on Silverlight for mobile devices?
I don't think so. I think this is an advertising play because so much advertising is Flash-based, either Flash video or Flash animation or something that's embedded in Flash. And so they have no choice because people who are building this kind of stuff do not want to make things twice.
But if you start giving, like for instance, Apple has not given in to Flash for the iPhone for many reasons. If Microsoft starts to give in to Flash in this area, can they ever really get that ground back?
They don't have a choice. I mean, this is the whole thing with Adobe Air. Adobe Air is an application that's portable. It plays on lots of different things, and the one of the things that's really important is that it's WebKit, but it's also Flash. And so Silverlight, when you compare the two, and in fact, the other thing is the Qt thing. It can play Flash as well. And so if you're comparing these platforms, Qt, Silverlight, Lake, Silver, what is it?
Silverlight. Silver Lake is in LA.
Yeah, okay. and Air, you're going to take Air because that's the one that's the most complete out of all of them. And so Microsoft has no choice but to offer this in the package of things. And in fact, it may just be no more than putting in the function calls so that Flash can play if it's already installed.
I mean, Flash has what, like 90% plus web browser?
98%.
Yeah, it's basically in every single web browser.
Right, and so that makes it a lot. Now, and most importantly, it's in YouTube, which has, according to I've never actually tried to say it.
Electronista.
Electronista.
It's very hard for me to say. YouTube gets a third of all video hits in January.
Mm-hmm.
That's third.
Huge.
3.36 billion hits.
So it's only a third. Where are the other 66% going? Is it all split up amongst all the other things?
Watching cat videos on other sites.
MySpace and Yahoo. I mean, Yahoo Video still gets a lot. For music videos, Yahoo does really well. I wish I had the numbers off the top of my head, but I looked them up a month or two ago for a story, and that's where Yahoo is still very, very strong, is in music videos. So I'm going to guess they had something. It was 166 million or billion in the month of December or January, whatever is the right metric there. So they're still doing a decent job when it comes to the purely professionally produced videos, not the skateboarding cats, but you know, the movie trailers and the music videos and whatnot.
Well, in another article that just came out in Yahoo News, is advertisers are shunning user generated videos. So while a third of the listeners third of the viewers are going to YouTube, they're having a hard time. Advertisers don't want to be part of, they don't want to be included with the user-generated work.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's no way to guarantee what your brand name's going to be appearing next to. There's a lot of, you know, association goes along with that. And if you know, it makes the brand look bad, then a brand marketer's not going to want to go into it.
Is this a problem for the Google AdSense approach to video advertising mixed with YouTube? Does this is more damaging than just being a little piece of text that's over on the side of somebody's blog?
Yeah, I'd say definitely. I mean, there's much more engagement involved with watching a video, and it's much more of a rich experience. Also, it's much more difficult for them to evaluate what the content is and to associate ads with it. If you're dealing with just text, it's fairly straightforward. You still see some errors occasionally with AdSense ads being horribly out of context, but it's easier to do with text, I would guess.
I think it would be funny that they would pay $100 million for a campaign for a car, and then the keywords make the car show up, but it's all about crashes.
Right.
I've seen stuff like that. I've seen stuff.
On my videos that are related to science, I always end up with ads being placed by creationists.
Oh.
You know, it's always stuff like the Creation Museum or this or that, and I'm like, just just goes against everything that this video is about.
But don't you want to take the money from the creation museum?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the same dollar.
I mean, talk about targeting the absolute wrong market.
Exactly.
We're going to target scientists with your creation. Yeah, yeah, great. Yeah.
So
great.
What that about all the video ad targeting firms out there, like Yumi Networks and Plugged and these folks that are saying they can match the video ads so something like that wouldn't happen?
Yeah.
Do you think... I mean, I get these press releases all the time as a reporter. You know, Yumi Network said today it did some deal with Spot Exchange and matched their inventory and so on and so forth. But do you think actually in the marketplace, like when you guys go to sites as consumers, do you feel that the video ads are matching what you're watching?
One thing I have to say is that broadcast hasn't figured this out yet. I mean, when I watch right. a broadcast TV show, I don't watch them very often. But when I watch Hulu, for instance, I mean that's not matching my.
Yeah, so like when you're watching Lost on Hulu, right?
Yeah. When I'm watching Lost on Hulu, I'm seeing Lost on Hulu.
Well, but I don't know.
No, it's Lost on ABC.
I don't think that's the same thing necessarily. Not that they should match you, Alex, but that they should match the content. And something like Lost is different. You're always going to find the brand advertisers there. You're going to find Lexus or whatever it is with Lost. I just mean that we're seeing sort of more niche content. Like Kirsten, this would be applicable to you. If you have a science video, and I don't know what type of advertisers would ideally be appropriate for that. But you know, think about the firms like Blinks. Everyone out there that's saying they do this in Digital Smith's video ad targeting. I just wonder. I mean, just kind of putting it out there because I'm thinking as a consumer, you know, when I go and watch videos, do I have that experience where the ads are contextually related when it's niche content, not when it's sort of the bigger broadcast fare? And I don't know that I'm seeing that really manifesting yet.
I was just going to say, I think that you have to find focused advertising. So when you go for these big blanket ad campaigns, you know, run of site or whatever it happens to be, where, you know, you just get advertisers to go on to, you know, advertise on MommyCast, advertise on Twist, advertise on Twim, advertise on, you know, whatever it happens to be, and they're all, you know, selling Charmin, you know, whereas you can get the focused sponsor that definitely is going to have that very related content, but that's going to go for a higher price. So it's how much you get for the advertising and, you know, for what you
Although
want.
Right now it's not going for a higher price, but the idea
is that
as this market becomes
more
vertical,
you go for the niche. Yeah.
As the market becomes more vertical in a specific area, then theoretically you should be paying a higher CPM, a higher cost per thousand. You know, because you know, when you look at a PC magazine, I think it's $120 CPM. You know, I mean, it's because it's very targeted. And when you look at a lot of these, when you look at a lot of this stuff, I mean, when I go through some of these magazines, I actually look at the ads almost as much as, like, once I've cut through Macworld magazine, I'll actually kind of flick through and look at the new, like, look for new items that I haven't seen yet. And it's kind of a weird, you know, I mean, we just got Sweetwater. Sweetwater they sell us all of our audio equipment. And it's really funny. I treat Sweetwater like a magazine. I mean, it's a catalog. It's like the old Sears catalog. I'm such a geek, but I sit there and I read about descriptions of compressors and mic preamps, and I'm like
that. Oh. And B&H catalog are actually part of my bathroom reading.
That and what?
B&H catalog.
Yes. B&H is good.
Oh, so I know, when I'm reading a science journal, I get really excited about those micropipettes.
So the key is that you do have to find a way to focus in on these, but right now I think the technology is something that is very difficult to do. You know, I think that
I don't think it's happening yet in the marketplace. I mean, I think there's a lot of talk, but I'm just not seeing it yet as a consumer that it's fully matching up to the content.
Yeah. Well, I think you look at all these businesses that are talking about putting ads in user generated content, and right now I don't see how it's going to scale because essentially they're going through and hand picking everything.
Right, exactly.
So there is no automated process. There is no Google AdWords or AdSense type algorithm that actually is matching ads with content.
Well, but that's what a lot of these video ads
do. Yeah.
That's what Blinks and Digital Smiths. I mean, a lot of them have a sort of speech recognition where it basically their software, you know, translates the video or the words that are being said into text so that it can match it and so on and so forth. So,
the question is, could you almost mechanically Turk this? Not so much from outside of the country, but what if you had I made a verb out of that.
I noticed that. Yeah.
I'm
nice.
Pretty proud of myself.
Nice, you know,
so, yeah, I'm gonna MT this. You know, so the so could you MT the process, which is, what if everyone was able to tag videos with lots and lots and lots of information, people who actually liked the video,
right?
And then you could search by those things. You know,
kind of like the metadata in Flickr, except for video and based on consumers.
People, you know, and crowdsource it to some degree. And then the most popular videos. I mean, a video that has 10 million views that a lot of people watch is also going to be more likely to be heavily tagged. The only problem is that...
Ironically, mistagged as well.
Well, and that's the thing, is then you have to have something that says, well, is it being tagged? Like, this is kind of how a match moving software works,
right?
Which is that I look at a whole bunch of points, and if 90% of the points are going one way, I'll throw away the 10% that are not. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, you throw away the ends, you keep the middle of the curve.
I don't see why you couldn't do it from a technology standpoint. I think the big issue right now is that they're targeting these big brand advertisers as their main advertisers, and they have different priorities. They really want to protect their brand. I think if you get an advertising market that's something like Google AdWords, where there's a lot of incremental advertisers that are coming in and just want to advertise for small dollar amounts, it doesn't need to be a huge campaign. I think if they can develop that kind of market for it, then I think it could work.
Yeah. I'm just going to make videos that take the video of whatever that's funny, and then I'm going to do asbestos over the top. So nice. It's really
that
heavily,
and target lawyers with it.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly. A great idea. And so it's just a funny video, but you can just turn down the sound. And so the robots and the taggers are going to go, oh yeah, it's about asbestos and lawyers. All right,
exactly.
I'm in. I'm going to get $35 in it.
You're going to make millions
now. Now, if you're not happy with YouTube, you can now... TiVo introduced a new desktop with iTunes podcasts. So this is on... this is once again from Electronista. Is that TiVo this morning pushed out an update to the TiVo desktop that helps turn its DVRs into network media hubs. The new version stresses the ability to pull podcasts and can either recognize them directly from iTunes on a network PC or else pull them directly through the RSS subscription. So now you can actually subscribe to
Beer
our podcast.
School.
To Beer School, to TWIM, to MacBreak, to This Week in Science,
to
Food Science,
Tech.
Daisy, or the New Media Minute, to all of the podcasts represented in this room.
I need a podcast.
You need a podcast. Where is your podcast?
I just realized that. I need a podcast. Okay. I'm going to get to work on that.
You two are the only ones without your own.
Oh, I'm working on it.
Okay, you're working on a podcast. And now you're working
on
it.
I am now working on a podcast.
Going on
as
in
of
here
right,
right
now,
now,
I'm working on a podcast.
So is this going to make a big impact on how many people are watching podcasts?
Well, it's going to make a little bit of impact because now I can say I'm on the TiVo as well as the iPod.
Right.
Which is good news. But the other thing is that this allows people that wouldn't normally, who have told me, well, I don't have an iPod. I'm like, okay. I'm not going to explain it. I'm over explaining it. I've tried for a year, and now I can say, well, do you have a TiVo? They go, yeah, okay, well, just cue it up on your TiVo.
Okay, those people are not going to do that. If somebody has not figured out how to work an iPod, they're not figuring out a TiVo. I mean, I use my iPod all the time. I have a TiVo at my house that has been sitting there for 3 years, and I know by and large how to make stuff work, and there's no way if somebody can't figure out an iPod that they're going to figure out how to get this. I mean, I think this stuff is good in a very small sort of in the microcosm that we live in. It'll add 1,000 viewers, or it'll add, you know, maybe 10,000 viewers here or there. But I don't think it's certainly not. I'm sitting here thinking big picture for TiVo and all of the different announcements that they have every single year and month. We have, you know, broadband functionality. We're now bringing in, you know, you can now link up. You can make your home wireless with TiVo. You can now access, you know, Turner content or whatever it is on your TiVo. But none of that has made TiVo the dominant DVR. I mean, still 90% of consumers that have DVRs are getting it from the evil cable company. And that's just the reality because it's so much easier. Right. I have both in my house. I'm sure. I have no doubt that TiVo's a much better device and much better functionality. It's just easier. At the end of the day, it's still just, you know, it was too complicated to set it all up. I mean, if you want to come over, Alex, and route my house, great. Absent that, I think this is, it's good incrementally. And to some degree, we're all kind of working in an incremental world. I mean, the stuff that we talk about, it's all based on, you know, incremental viewership and incremental consumers. But I don't think it makes a difference for TiVo.
Do we, from a podcaster's point of view, is this going going to, of the people who have figured out how to use TiVo and are using the TiVo desktop, does this open a new audience that's going to significantly affect our listenership or viewership?
Just knowing how tech savvy most TiVo users are, they probably have already figured out podcasting and are probably already downloading it. There's probably good overlap there. But as soon as it starts appearing in those awful Motorola DVR boxes you get from Comcast, I'll be excited.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. We'll know within 3 months because we'll see it in our server logs.
True.
You know, it'll show up as that. It'll say something TiVo as the client that grabbed it.
Except did you read the full story? It's not available on the Mac. It only works on Windows. So
then maybe that is a new audience.
And then there's a really weird. I can't quite figure this out. There's a really weird situation where it actually has to be running on your Windows PC in order to have this functionality.
Oh, no.
So it's this kind of media hub / in tandem with / Apple TV failure take one.
Born to fail.
Yeah. Well,
you're really needing like the tech experts to be able to know how to use it.
You thought TiVo was hard before.
The thing is that this is 1.0 and this gets fixed pretty quickly.
I don't know. TiVo hasn't given me any confidence in that happening.
Okay. Can we talk about something else? because obviously we just didn't, they're going to go, well, once again, you didn't read the article. I'm like, I did read the article.
So we
totally read the article. Desktop software.
With all of this happening, one of the questions is that are we really, this was in Coop's Corner on CNET. Are we wrong about tech and the democratization of media? So the idea is all of this opportunity that seems to be occurring, and this was based on a state of the news media report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which I'm a little worried when I started hearing that. Yeah. A couple of the major trends that were pointed out by this state of the news media is news is shifting from being a product. Today's newspaper, website, or newscast is becoming a service. How can you help me or even empower me? A news organization, a news website are no longer final destinations. So this isn't where we go to find our information. This is where we start to find our information. The prospects for user-created content once thought possibly central to the next era of journalism now appear to be more limited, even among citizen sites and blogs. And so they're arguing that that's not really expanding. This isn't really going to become the democratization where everybody's getting all this information. And finally, there's two things. They said the agenda of the news media is becoming more narrow, increasingly the newsroom is perceived to be more innovative and experimental. And it said that Madison Avenue, rather than pushing change, appears to be having trouble keeping up with it, which I think is the most true thing that was in this study.
Yeah, that last is definitely.
Right. That's fair to say, but a lot of that, I don't know, I'm sorry, some of that just kind of sounds like mumbo jumbo, frankly. I mean, what does that mean, a product or service? Do any of you even think at all during the day, is this a product or service? Whatever it is that you're consuming, whether it's a Coke or a newspaper. And I just, I think that when I want to find political news, I will first go to CNN.com, ABCNews.com, or New York Times. If I just want a specific story, BlackBerry outages or something, then I go to Google News, and who cares then? But I'm never thinking, is this a product or service? And I bet the reason it says the agenda is narrowing, if that's what it said, that's just because we're in election year. That's why it's saying the agenda is narrowing. Of course, because
I'm going
to
kill somebody.
I just want to quote the byline from the Project for Excellence in Journalism website. An initiative by journalists to clarify and raise the standards of American journalism through research and education. After reading that and the name of the actual group that put out the report, it kind
They're
of
not biased
an interesting
at all.
Light. Yeah, it seemed extremely biased, and then I saw what the name of the project was and went and checked up on them.
All the blogs. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, they are.
Well, one of the things
smash them down, that community journalism.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that we're talking on a day that was almost I do my stationary thing, my stationary bike thing for a long time every day, and I was watching the news today, which was dominated by Barack Obama putting up a speech. Which, of course, is available on YouTube.
Of course.
That was precipitated by a post that someone put On YouTube.
On YouTube.
You know, mm-hmm. so the entire news media, the entire news industry has been wrapped around and swirling for the last 3 or 4 days over something that someone ripped off of a DVD and threw up on YouTube. Not even a very good recording, by the way. And the whole thing was all squished or one way or the other. But
which really sort of gives the lie to that point right there about the impact of user-generated or consumer media. I mean, I still think, and yes, I am a traditional journalist. I'm a print journalist, and you know, I hope to some degree that we're viable and people want to read articles where they're sourced properly. But I think, yes, absolutely, the stuff that I report is completely being influenced now by the stuff that regular people are putting out there. Great. It's interesting when other people get to set the agenda. We have to, as reporters, have to respond to it more so.
Do we think that it's going to, do we think that we're really losing democratization, or do we think that it's actually increasing?
I'd say it's increasing. I think this is just a very biased report. They have a very definite agenda that they're pushing. You know, it goes through and it talks about, so advertising is not accompanying the online migration with the consumer. That sentence alone doesn't make any sense. Since when does advertising not follow where the consumers are? That's their lifeblood.
Well, the other thing that happens is that if you take advertising or the need to make money out of what you are saying, then it changes the whole thing. You are doing it because you want to, because you're doing it for a service, because you had a problem with a company or something else, and you're basically saying, whatever sucks or whatever is awesome or whatever that is. And so if by taking the money out of it, now you have an agenda, right? And so with the thing with journalism, with traditional journalism, it's about selling papers, and inside the paper comes a bunch of advertising.
Well, and I think that we hear this every time there's a revolution. We hear that the masses at the gates, you know, aren't worthy. You know, when I started doing print design when I was an intern getting paid $3.50 an hour, and but I wasn't a designer, you know, and all I did is I learned how to use Photoshop, I learned how to use Illustrator, and I persuaded the sports network that I worked for to fire their ad agency and let me do all the regional print ads, you know, and I got bumped to $7 an hour. You know, I was pretty proud of. You know, but they had to cut my hours in half because I was only budgeted for a certain amount.
Dope.
So, but the point was is that there were a whole lot of us. This is the early 90s, you know, 90, 92, 93. And there were all of us, and we weren't designers, and we weren't any good at it. We didn't go to school. We didn't, you know, learn how to draw. We didn't learn how to do any of that stuff. We just were, you know, we knew how to use these newfangled tools. And out of it grew a much different kind of design. It was much less staid. I mean, you had Raygun, which was totally unreadable, but really fun to look at. But out of all of that stuff, we ended up with magazines. We ended up with other things that are much more aggressively designed because there was this new push. And I mean, even the number of magazines we have out now, it wasn't the case. It wasn't that big 20 years ago because it was harder to make them. You know, and now we have a lot more of these niches that are served by magazines alone based on that. And no one else has anything to say. Now the Times Online, of course, is talking about your TV is about to blow apart. Do not adjust your set. The TV is about to blow apart. And this is from
Andrew. Why is there a penguin on the telly? <Not yet.
laughs> So this is from Andrew Sullivan. This is on the Times Online UK. This is not Times US.
That's why there's a penguin.
And what he's talking about is that the idea that we're ever going to return to just coming home and watching whatever's going to be on the TV, those days are over.
That was over 5 years ago.
For you.
I don't think generally it is over yet. I think the majority, there's still a large number of people here in the U.S. and around the world who go home to their televisions at night. Excuse me. I just did last night. I was tired. There was, you know, I hadn't planned out what I wanted to watch. I didn't want to open my computer. I didn't want to think. I went home. I nuked some food. Sat
some vegetables.
In front of Fezzingen. It was a very nice Persian meal. That's good. nuked my dinner, and I just passed out in front of the television with my eyes open, staring at whatever was on. I think it was The Girls Next Door. You know, I was...
That sounds like fun. I want to do that tonight. That's what I
want to do. I took my remote and I flipped channels. Until every time the commercials came on, I flipped to a new channel. I mean, people still do that a lot. And that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Now, here's the question is that if they're doing that a lot now. Would they continue to do that? if they were able to, for instance, subscribe to all the shows that they like. Like we subscribe to podcasts.
Obviously not, because they can't figure out their TV.
Right.
But if the average person, let's
jump 5 years into the future, or 10 years into the future, maybe.
Wait, no, that's back in time.
So we jump forward, and we imagine where you're watching a show, and you can just hit a button on your remote that just says subscribe. And now it's just going to grab those no matter what. It's going to grab one or grab all the, you know, I'm on 24,
right.
And I tuned into number 6. I'm like, oh, this is great, but I have no idea what's going on. So give me the last 5. Right. You know, so download the last 5. They have, you know, let's say they have ads in them or whatever, you know. But the point is, I could just subscribe to it, and it would just pull all those and then give me all the new ones as they come out. Would people rather do that, collect a bunch of it, and is this what TiVo really does anyway?
DVRs from Comcast, that's what they do. I mean, you subscribe, well, you get your entire series recording of whatever.
Is that how you use your DVR?
Well, yeah, and that's what my kids do. I mean, when yours is older, and probably your older kids do that as well. I mean, my son thinks I'm a bad parent. I let him watch Nickelodeon. I let him watch PG-13 movies and all sorts
of stuff. Eat lots of candy, drink lots of soda. I mean,
yeah, just sit there in front of the TV. But he really thinks everything can be fast forward. It's kind of funny. You know, fast forward the commercial. Like, you know what? Darling, you're watching it in real time right now. I actually say that stuff to him. What are you talking about?
We have some friends where that's their kids are the exact same way.
Exactly.
And it's a new way of looking at television as the way that you consume it. But I don't think that TV is going to go away. I mean, it's not. I mean, people are still going to make half hour or hour long or that 22 minute and 45 minute long programs to fit in around the advertisements.
I got to tell you, I can't wait for The Office to come back. I just want to like veg out again on Thursday nights. That was my night to look forward to. I had Grey's Anatomy in The Office. I didn't do any work. I got away from my computer and sat down on my couch. I actually used to watch Grey's Anatomy live, and I watched it with the commercials. I was so old school.
All right, so I'm still five years in the future, and so I'm going to describe some things that you're going to go, oh, wow, I didn't know that was possible. So, so one of the things that will happen is that social networks will be everywhere. And so your social group will be watching shows, and you will watch shows that your network is watching. So there will be no accidentally finding episode 6 of something, because you're going to jump into number 1 because your group is saying this is awesome, you should watch this.
Like my friends said just recently in the last couple of years for Battlestar Galactica and yay, thanks for Netflix, so I could go back to episode 1 and watch them all over again. Right. Or, you know, South Park in college when we all would get together on Wednesday. That's right, on Wednesday night, and we'd all get together and watch it together.
Right. But then social networks
have been doing that for a while.
Yeah, but the idea is that it'll talk directly to your television, so it'll just show up there.
It could be a lot more. Yeah, you have your. It's no longer you have your people talk to my people. You have your thing talk to my thing.
Right. Yeah.
And we'll work it out. No, the thing is it also could be much more efficient. Yeah. You know, so for instance, I could say, make me a group. I rate all these videos that I like, good, bad, whatever. Make me a group of people all over the world that has this percentage of correlation. So it could be 60%, 80%, 90% correlation. And then so it makes that group, you know, there's a big group there. And then I say, now, if more than, and I could decide 30, 40, 50% of that, maybe 60% of that population rate something as good, I just want to see it. I want to know what that is. And I didn't pick that group. It's not a social network of people I grew up with in school or went to college with. It's people who just happen to be correlated with the things that I happen to like. No matter how random and weird it is, they are as random and weird as I am. You know, and the idea is that through that 6 degrees of separation, you could actually be acquiring information that is still new to you. It's not something that you would go out and look for, but is something that is likely to, and this is what Netflix is trying to figure out, and this is what everybody's trying to figure out, but they don't give, I think the problem is they don't give the users enough control over deciding how tightly wound or loosely wound that
is. That's because the users can't figure out how to use their TiVo. So the other thing that's going to happen is that advertising is going to become more useful to me. So, for example, because this refrigerator and because the car and because something else talks to everything, so when I'm watching media, doesn't matter what it is, then the TV will say, oh, by the way, you need to get tires, and then there'll be tire ads there. The next day, it'll be like, there's need for car wash. There's a need for, there's no food in the fridge. There's never food in the fridge. But anyway, the idea, or pizza ads, come on. It's specifically targeted toward me, and it's helping me make decisions. And
helping you make decisions. That's a very big brother.
Except there's
her.
Soda in your fridge, but it's the wrong soda.
I don't drink soda anymore. It's evil.
By default, I'm going to go like 10 minutes into the future, and like we're going to put a little tiny, you know, little watching camera box on in your TV. So your TV's always watching you and listening to you. So if you didn't already see that? I think I want Indian for dinner. All of a sudden it's telling you that, you know, whatever, you know, Indian restaurant down the street is really good.
So when you're watching the girls next door, the telescope actually moves there?
Yeah. That's funny.
So now.
I think I was going to say, going back to the TV about to blow apart, I think the other part of this article that was really interesting is the question of whether or not like some shows, like comedy shows or skit-based shows, are going to make their programming shorter format to fit within the 3-minute attention span of the online viewer. You have the long-form programming, but are some shows actually going to make their programming so that it can have dual purpose?
I mean, I have to admit, I'm working on a little series that we're putting together, and it is 50 episodes that are between 1 and 2 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, and the thing is that it's designed as it's still high production value. It's designed for the YouTube generation.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's still a story.
That's my podcast.
That sounds like quarter life.
Beginning, middle, and end.
You could put it all together and sell it to NBC.
Film that I'm
right.
doing in segments.
Right.
Full production quality. The whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, there have been a lot of like little animated shorts and lots of things of that. I mean, for a while I was totally addicted to Ninjai,
right? Exactly,
the little ninja, and you know, I just wanted to watch what was going to happen to him on this venture.
What you're talking about is really similar to the quarter life model.
Exactly. It is
kind of, you know, stitch. I mean, we know that failed, but it's like, okay, take a longer thing, separate it for the internet, think, stitch it back together.
But
for TV.
I guess I'm not designing.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, I'll say that I'm not designing it. The stuff that we're working on, we're not actually designing for ever to be on TV.
Right, exactly. Because if you look at something like
the idea is that
Pink the series, which an acquaintance of mine worked on, Pink the series did really well.
Yeah.
4 million viewers, a $6 million deal.
That's great.
You know, to do a television show, and it was designed from the ground up to be on the web, and it was webisodic. And if you haven't checked it out, pinktheseries.com. It's unbelievably
good. And is it inconceivable?
It's HD,
though,
well done.
Let's say your show is a big success, and your people, your followers, your fans want to watch it all, and you know, you start to break out, you're more mainstream.
You sell a DVD. Really,
exactly. That's my point.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you have to put it on TV, but somehow.
No, you release a set of DVDs
or
stitch
it back together.
High def,
I mean, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it's like a little accordion. Yep. It goes
however
you
want. Totally watch it. It would be a 2-hour movie.
And that's what they did with
Show. Yeah. I would not watch a show about accordions.
Well,
you gotta take a stand, John.
But what if it was an accordion hitman?
Speaking of putting these little shorts together, have you guys seen this Nine Inch Nails Ghosts Film Festival?
Amazing.
Not yet.
Trent just keeps on going.
I think it's great.
No, number one, we talked last week. You know, he just released it. The news came out between last show and this show that he has already grossed $1.6 million in revenue from a set of CDs that don't have any vocals. It's all instrumental.
Yeah.
You can put your vocals on there if you want.
Yeah, you can.
You know, there's no reason. I mean, it's actually allowed. You can say.
I think some of the songs are actually available in GarageBand?
They're all.
Yeah.
No. I think not yet.
There's maybe it was the last album, was all done in GarageBand.
Yeah, the last one was with Teeth was available in GarageBand.
Right. So,
just gave it out for free.
So but this one, he's made $1.6 million.
By the way, personally, with no label.
Personally,
mm-hmm.
no label. No lyrics. You know, this is I mean, you know, it's this is the first week. The thing is that I still think that artists have to, and especially as, and he's not even what I would consider, you know, he's not an A-level artist. He's a great artist, but he's not like he's not like Sting, you know.
Not like superstar, mega band or anything like
right.
that.
Right, and we've seen other people, we talked about it before, Peter Gabriel has done this and probably made as more than this. You know, Peter Gabriel never released the numbers, but I'm sure that he made, my guess is in the last album, he probably made $10 to $20 million just from Genesis and Peter Gabriel fans.
Amazing.
You know, I forked over my money with no issue whatsoever. Yeah. And so the thing is that, and the question is really, why do these bands, and maybe this gets back to being easy, maybe it's just too easy for the band, you know, someone sends them a check, someone figures it out, you know. Someone else is figuring it all out for them. But the reality is that they don't really, especially the large artists, don't really need the labels. And if the large artists realized that they didn't need the labels, how long would the labels exist?
Well, I mean, they're in the process of dying as we speak. And I think you hit there, though, with the large artists, the ones that already have established audiences, basically built through the advertising, you know, and promotion machines of the labels, are the ones that are doing well with this transition. But,
well, it's not just them. I mean, Annie DeFranco.
She's been independent forever.
She's, you know, has been independent from
And bands
from
like Spoon that actually got rid of their label and are doing great independently also.
Right.
But the ones that are really making, you know, these $1 million plus, you know, products and selling them directly it seems like so far we've had Radiohead, we've had Nine Inch Nails.
But Nine Inch Nails is not, I mean, to put it in perspective, they've not had a serious hit for a decade.
True. Yeah, since the early 90s.
But same kind of for Radiohead, right? I mean, didn't have their last two albums before this one, they haven't been terribly well regarded, you know, besides OK Computer.
And the thing is like a band like XTC, mm-hmm. you know, one of my favorite bands. So the XTC, not ecstasy, by the way, it's XTC. And if you don't own English Settlement, you need to run out and buy it. It's classic.
Don't run, just click.
Yeah, just click. Just click away. You can download the whole thing. So anyway, XTC is a perfect example of a band that couldn't tour after a while because the lead singer had a problem with tour. He got stage fright. And they had very little support from their band, if any. And they built a cult following because people really were into the music. They were into the lyrics. They were into the music. Not a lot of it was even poppy. But when a new XTC came out, everybody bought it. I mean, everybody that knew about them would buy it. And it's enough to, you know, they might have gotten some start, but I've never heard XTC. I've almost never heard XTC on the radio.
Mm-hmm. You're not listening to the right station. They play it on
K-Fog stations.
They play it on K-Fog. They play it on...
Oh, dear God.
Dear God.
Yeah, they also...
Okay, that's one...
No,
I definitely heard that on the radio.
Yeah, no, that's the one song. They've there's like 12 albums or something. You know, so that, you know, it's very... But they survive on the fact that people know about them.
Oh, yeah. My point wasn't that it's not possible for bands to do this well who aren't already huge, just that the ones that have done really well so far are bands that were already at least fairly large through the standard music industry before they did this.
Yeah, I wonder, though, how much of the bands that are doing these free music download, you know, basically giving away their albums for free to see how much money they get from it, how much of what they're doing is based on PR for the fact that they're doing something novel and that they're getting a lot of media out of it.
Yeah, but the question is,
I've read a lot about, like, I mean, Reznor actually is doing a lot of really interesting PR. Like, he's been doing a lot of underground stuff, like putting like secret messages out, and like it's been like leading fans on a little treasure hunt.
That's partly because his fans are that way.
Right.
You know, and that's part of the issue. And we're talking about $1.6 million revenue that he's generated from an album, and we're not even talking about the tour yet.
Right. I'm just wondering if this is going to be the standard for artists as we move forward and as the record labels start to, you know, deteriorate more and more. Is this going to be the way that it works, and are artists going to really be able to maintain themselves and make money by releasing?
And that's the great unknown. Does this trickle down to the smaller bands? Does this just work? And I have no idea. And going to be really interesting to find out.
I think that one of the things we always have to keep in perspective is how the little bands are doing with the labels right now. Which is that, my perfect example is a lot of these little bands, they get picked up, by the label.
Yeah, they lose money. It's like they start out. Yeah.
Or you get an example like
you're in debt.
One of my favorite bands in Pittsburgh was a band called the Affordable Floors.
Right.
We love the Affordable Floors. You know, we were crazy about them, and we were excited that they got picked up by Universal. And so Universal picks them up and then goes through restructuring in the early 90s while the album has been recorded. Now, for a new band, one of the best albums you're going to have, usually in the first three, it's going to be your first album because those are the songs you've been playing over and over and over and over again. And you've got them figured out. You've got the whole thing sorted out. So their best work goes to Universal. They record it in the studio. They have all this money. They put it all together. And then Universal goes through the restructuring, decide they're not going to release the album. But who owns the copyright? Universal owns the copyright. And so now it's stuck in a vault. Universal doesn't want to give it up. And this is not an exception. This is classic. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a classic issue of the record companies and how a small band, we may think that they're, you know, they don't have a chance if they do it on their own. But statistically, they don't have a chance when they work with a record label either.
Now, I mean, isn't also just the classic deal, it didn't even go wrong. Here's a huge advance. Oh, and by the way, you have to pay for the production, the distribution, and everything else.
You have to pay for the flights when they fly you from your hometown or whatever in Tulsa to New York to have meetings and everything else. You're paying for all of that. You're paying for the catering that's sitting there while they're talking to you. You're paying for all of that stuff.
You can't decide exactly where the production's happening or the quality of it or whether you want to have catering or...
Exactly.
So it's kind of a classic thing, right? Here's the money. Oh, and by the way, you have to pay for all the stuff and now you're in debt and so now you have to put the album out.
Yeah, and if you don't hit a home run... You know, they're not going to come after your house or anything else. You're just not going to see anything, and you're not going to see that work again. And if you're lucky, you didn't sign a multi.
Right. Most artists don't make any money until they renegotiate a second album or a third.
Right. You have to do well. You have to come out at that on the other side of it and say, okay, now I want more than a penny in an album.
Yeah. It's no different than getting a film distribution deal. I mean, if you're a filmmaker and you get a distribution deal, you're going to get charged for everything. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of points they give you. If you don't get the money up front, whatever you get on the back end is zero. I mean, they're going to find some accounting way to show
it. It's like anything you get in advance for, a book, a CD, a DVD, whatever.
I don't know. I found books to be a little different. I mean, there doesn't seem to be such a
You write for the advance and maybe you get something back, especially with tech.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to admit, that's what's kept me out of books.
In the science realm, everyone who's an author, they just say, well, you get the advance and hope that pays for the amount of time that you spend writing the book.
And then
the next book deal that you do, you get a bigger advance because you're a proven author, but that's what you're going to get.
My experience with books is a lot different. My experience is you get either a very, very small advance or no advance at all.
I think it depends on what kind of book.
And then you get a percentage. Yeah, well, I've written fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But I've never had any problem with someone trying.
I think we're coming from a technical background. People who wanted us to write have been technical.
And in the technical world.
I wrote Enterprise Linux Security. It was really good. It was a bestseller, actually.
So. But I'm going to make a lot of money. And you look at the royalty deal that you're going to get, and you're like, okay. But if you get 6,000 or 12,000, right.
I'm not saying I'm buying a house with it. I'm just saying that whatever percentage they agree to is usually the percentage I see. And I don't think that's the case with the music industry or the film industry. I think we're going to give you a percentage of, you know, on the back end, and it's a big fat lie. I mean, it's just like they're going to find every way in the world to not pay. Speaking of finding ways of not paying,
Ziff Davis.
Oh man.
Oh boy.
Ziff Davis. Okay, I just have to say the thing that stuck out. Ziff Davis is declaring bankruptcy. And
we have to clarify which one, because there's two.
Ziff. I'm sorry. Ziff,
there's two kinds of bankruptcy. There's Ziff, Chapter 7,
right,
which is you're done, and then there's chapter 11, which is restructuring.
They're doing chapter 11 restructuring. They filed chapter 11 to protection to restructure the debt. Basically, what happened was they got an agreement with most of their creditors. So they the senior creditors agreed to everything, and they're going to get they're only going to have to pay $57 million out of the $225 million that they owe, but they're going to give away 88.8% of the common stock.
Well, that's one debtor.
No. Senior creditors. Yeah. So it's a series of them. But here's the problem. Here's the problem further down. This is in the AP Press or Associated Press. The company's filing states that there are between 1,000 and 5,000 creditors. Wow.
Sucks to be in the print media.
Roughly.
Wow.
But that means they've gone from press to press to press over the years to keep their book going.
Wow. I mean, I just and the thing is that most of the stuff that, as I said, they got sorted out. What they couldn't do is they couldn't get to a lot. They couldn't come to an agreement with the junior creditors over how much stock that they were going to, you know, or payments or whatever. And so they had to go to court to try to sort all of that out. You know, it looks like, I mean, it seems like a company that started well, started in the 20s. I mean, this thing is almost 100 years old.
It just cracks me up, the quote.
I know.
I feel
I'm
we're
dying.
In a position poised for wonderful growth.
Well, that's what you have to say.
The Jason chief executive Young. Says, yeah.
But it's,
we just needed to solve this issue. Well,
this tiny little half a billion dollar in debt issue.
It's small. You know, it's a little problem.
Yeah. We're restructuring and giving up 88% of our common stock. It's a gnat, really.
I heard that's what they said at Bear Stearns, you know. It was like, we're doing great. Only lost 90% of our value.
Did you guys
overnight.
Catch that one of the agreements on the table with the junior creditors is to give up the remaining 11.2% of the common stock?
Right, but that's just the common stock.
Yeah,
there's a lot of other stock.
So basically all the common stock, just throw it all out there and see you'll take it.
So this is the biggest issue, is that this book, the main magazine, which is PC Magazine, has gone from this big, thick tome, which was, I don't know, 500 or 600 pages per issue, to something that's on the order of 150 pages. It's looking a lot like Mac Addict magazine.
Well, you know, all these magazines, though. I mean, a lot of these magazines I get now that are, especially the technical ones, and I find it's fascinating how thin they've gotten. I mean, because I can remember a day when these things were like, they were tomes, you know, and now we're looking at these magazines that are just, they're like pamphlets.
You can read them in about 15
minutes. I mean, DB Magazine is like a pamphlet.
But it always was.
That's the Flowers economic model.
It got thicker.
Have you seen that, the Flowers economic model?
No.
It is that the number of ads in a magazine such as Wired is in direct correlation to the number of startups being funded and the amount of wealth in the economy. I actually have a formula that works out to, like, over 10 years, it works out to within a page of the number of pages of advertising in Wired magazine.
Oh,
how's it looking?
Yeah. Well, and Wired did the same thing, because Wired was a book that was about 250 pages when it first came out, and then it grew to bigger books.
Ginormous.
Right?
It got to a point where you couldn't read it.
Dot Bomb, and it was suddenly Wired again.
Suddenly Wired again.
And then it was started getting fat again, and now it's thin again.
I think it's way better now, though.
You know, Wired
now is going through, I think it's going, or the last year or so, it's been going through a very positive.
Now, they abandoned the brain hemorrhage color scheme that they were on. Remember the sideways writing and the different colors and the, you know, 3D glasses to read it?
Well, I think the new editor has been, actually the new editor-in-chief, you know, or the publisher or whatever, has been a good influence. I mean, it's, what I like about Wired is it's really designed for us who are ADD. And
you mean you?
Me. It, Wired, the two magazines.
It has an audience of one at $4 a month.
My two print avenues to the world are Wired and The Economist.
And that's read to you now.
And so, what I love about Wired and The Economist is all the stories are short. I can actually I can actually get through a whole story in one sitting. We won't talk about what kind of sitting, but I can actually make through a whole story, sometimes two. And that's very important. You know, now speaking of funding and startups, Next New Networks draws $15 million to build a video empire.
Wow, yay! $15 million buys you a video empire. I thought it was $1.5 billion.
Evidently, $15 million
on top of nine.
They're forgetting some zeros there in their. In their number.
I want to say that this is no offense to Stephanie Olson, who wrote this article. This article is just an indication to me of what's happening to CNET.
It's a regurgitation of a press release.
It's a regurgitation of a press release.
Which is what everybody
does.
And then except for Daisy.
I don't never do that.
But then they add, they add phrases like, you know, build a video empire. You know, to attract readers.
Can I just have to butt in here? We as reporters don't write the headlines, okay? That's what gets the most attention. And it is amazing what I look at some days. I have my Google News alert for myself and my story comes through.
So who writes the headlines?
Oh, it depends on the publication. At TV Week, it's, you know, one of the editors or the copy editors. And sometimes I'll look at it and think, but that has nothing to do with the story. It's marketing. Yeah. We have to market and get people to read it. So they say things like build a video empire and YouTube kills on views this month or whatever it is. It's just to get readers.
Now, yeah. I have to admit that some of these, what Next New Network is doing is they're building lots of these channels, you know, these networks.
Micro networks.
So some of the ones that they put together, Indie Mogul is the one that I've actually seen. You know, so independent filmmakers talking about, and some of it's pretty, you know, it's basic, but useful for people who are, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm. But they have Channel Federator, which has got some more popular stuff on it. Barely Political, Political Comedy, you know, Barely Daily.
I like Viral Pop. That's a good green show.
Is it good?
I have that on my RSS. Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I mean, there's really good information. Just the other day, it was on where to get, you know, just different places online that you could find green business cards, you know, recycled business cards. And yes, sure, I could plug that into Google too, but it's just this kind of nice to have that reminder of, oh, yeah, next time I get business cards, I should do that. And I had it in mind because of that show. So if anybody is into sort of new green tips or what's going on in that, I find that a very good show to watch.
And I think that what we're seeing here is this is going to be that digital arms race between the on networks, the next new networks, the revision threes, of all these networks are, you know, they're going, you know, we saw it starting and some were fortunate to start early enough to kind of figure out some of the pieces. But I definitely think that we're going to see this, you know, this is going to be like the web. The only thing better for us as media developers is that you're going to need more people than you need for the web.
So, a lot more money to go around and spend on more production.
More money. So, but there's going to be a lot of production. But you have to figure out how to do it. I think that all of these networks, the problem that they have is that most of their people who could make content for them are people who are glorified videographers or independent filmmakers who never, you know, just kind of figuring stuff out, and they're very artsy, or they're guys that worked in TV or film who
straight
will never touch something for less than $3,000 a finished minute. Mm-hmm. And so the issue is that it's figuring out, these guys have to figure out, how do we thread, you know, probably, I think it's pretty much the $500 to $1,500 a finished minute. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the kind of the less than $5,000 for a 3 to 5 minute piece. Is that I think that's kind of a sweet spot, you know, of that all these networks have to kind of figure out. And I think that's why they're getting money, is to figure it out more.
I want to raise a question about web video. It's something I've been thinking about a lot since South by Southwest. So it kind of ties into what you're talking about. Now, I was there last week, as, you know, a lot of us here were. And, you know, it's this whole indie culture, and everybody knows everybody. I'm very insidery. First time I was there, but, you know, everybody's like, oh, hey, Kent, and you know, hi, Steve, and, oh, it's Jonathan Colton, and let's, you know, get down and about, which is, hey, I love what he's done. And then I started thinking, my God, is web video just this giant echo chamber where, by and large, I mean, yes, my dad has watched the Sarah Silverman, Matt Damon video. Everybody has seen that. You know, regular people have seen the Will I Am, Yes We Can video. But stuff like this, I mean, I like Viral Pop, but I cover web video. And I just wonder if these shows are being watched by the same 50,000 or 100,000 people. Those people being us here, media producers, reporters covering web video, other folks that have podcasts out there, the production houses. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to see a study on that that really looks at who these viewers actually are and what percentage of web video show viewers, not YouTube viral video viewers, are coming from the same group of people.
I absolutely think that there's a lot of crossover. Outside.
Yeah, well, this is the
and
whole
are we all just
inside baseball
other?
Thing, right?
Well, but I
mean, right. there's this collection of people, the outspoken, vocal, you know, 1% who watch all of this stuff and comment on it. I mean, if you look at something like, in the tech world, you look at something like Slashdot, or you look at something like, you know, Twitter, or, you know, you start to look at these things. Yeah, I mean, there's a strong correlation between all of the people who are involved in this and the people who are making all of the noise and those sort of things. I think you're absolutely right.
And then I just wonder if that has value, like financially. I mean, if it's all just all of us posting on each other's blogs and watching each other's stuff. And I'm going to be honest here. There are some web video shows I really like, but some shows I just watch on mute just to support the producer. I like the producer. I'm not going to say what the show is, but I like the producer. It's just content that I'm not interested in personally, but I want to support them and give them a view. So when I get the email that they've got a new video up, I click on the video and I put the mute down and I let it play in the background. So I...
Well, and the thing is I think that the key is, and I think you're right. I mean, I think that a lot of us, we grew very, very quickly. You know, we jumped, a lot of these viewerships jumped very, very fast, but there seems to be this limit of about 100... in true numbers, and I'm not talking about inflated, crazy numbers that people throw around, but in true numbers, somewhere between 150 and 250,000 viewers, there seems to be a glass ceiling at the moment where it's very, very difficult to get more than that as a repeatable...
Well, that's because the number of people who know how to use the technology to a point where they can sufficiently access the information that you're putting out there, the video, I mean, all of these different content types and things, is about 250,000.
Okay.
And you look at...
You were talking
earlier about, you know, in 5 years, we're going to hit this button and, you know, it's going to say subscribe and we're going to, you know, watch these shows. We're going to turn these knobs. I think you're grossly overestimating the things that people are willing to do with their television. First of all, the word subscribe alone, no one is going to know what the hell you're talking about. Well, it's going to have to say watch all.
What I would say is that I would argue that I'm not talking about everyone. What I'm talking about are the
250,000.
No. I am talking about the only people that advertisers really care about, which is 18 to 34. You know, and the thing is this is a generation that is coming into...
Very computer literate.
They are extremely...
Not at all.
Very media illiterate.
They're media literate. Yeah, I mean, if you look at illiterate, right?
No, literate. Very media literate.
No way. If you look at what's happening with the youth right now, they are less computer literate.
They're phone literate.
They're literate with Twitter. They're literate with MySpace. They're literate with all of these different things. But their ability to use computers in the way that the generation before them
used computers. What do you mean? Use them for what?
Well, the difference is that
no legitimate understanding of technology in any meaningful way compared to the generation before them.
But why is that bad? So what if this generation wants to use MySpace? That's what this generation wants to do online.
I am not judging. I am simply saying that to say that they are computer literate is not correct.
Well, I have to say that my only data point. You know, in this is my older kids who are 10 and 13.
Right.
And when I look at the sophistication that they have, and I'm not around them all day.
Is it sophistication or is it an absolutely in-depth and amazing understanding of certain things, but not a broad understanding?
But it's pretty broad.
Okay. I mean, you know, I think
they might be the exception. I really think the data supports that a lot of people right now, 18 to 25, their general understanding of technology is really low, but the depth of understanding of specific technologies is very, very high.
I read a study like a week or two ago that was talking about like young girls coming into their own on the web, and like there are a lot of young girls who are creating blogging websites, who are doing their own online videos and putting things up, and like boys are just kind of like not doing that as much.
But you don't need an understanding of the technology to create a blog.
No, right. You don't have to understand the... But does anybody need to understand the underlying technology to be able to access the media? If you can build a blog,
you can subscribe on iTunes.
Yeah,
and you're likely to be using iTunes. I would say that there's a high correlation between people who know how to build a blog and people who are listening to iTunes. And so if you have lots and lots of people, a growing percentage using iTunes.
The difference between using iTunes and using iTunes to subscribe to a podcast is a pretty significant difference.
It depends on how important those. Some of it as media developers, part of our onus is to make content that is worth people telling their friends about. You know, the thing is if we make content, I mean, most of the content, 99.9999% of all the podcasts out there are unwatchable and unlistenable.
Right.
But here's
the issue. The issue is...
Possibly right now.
The way that people consume media right now is that they watch something like on television. I think the way the average person consumes media is they watch something on television and they find things either by someone else saying, hey, you should watch this, or they find it sort of by accident by flipping the channels.
I guess people don't
really go out and actively search
for content.
But like,
for instance, I got that video. We were watching this video.
But how are you supposed to find a podcast if you can't... I guess what I'm saying is right now it is not possible to accidentally stumble upon a podcast. It's not like television where you're just flipping through the channels and this week in media.
Well,
let's kind of cool.
Wait a minute.
It's much more like you know someone who knows someone. I mean, you talked about a glass. Yeah, but you can't have it both ways, though, right? You talk about a glass ceiling.
I'm going to.
No, and there's a low viewership, and I'm saying
that there's a glass ceiling, and there's a reason for it right now. What I'm looking at is that as we move, you know, as we start seeing TiVo, for instance, incorporating this stuff, as we start seeing cable networks wanting to get away from simply. Cable networks needed to differentiate themselves. They need to take the on-network content. They need to take the new next new media content, the Revision 3 content. They need to get that on their networks as video on demand because they need to fill data. You know, they just need to throw that stuff. As we start to see that crossover, I think then our audiences start to change. I mean, like, for instance, I was talking to a cable network. Not a cable network. One of these online networks. And some of their stuff ended up on Comcast,
right?
And they got a reality, you know, a data reality of what the difference is between broadcast and you know, online.
Right.
That one time that their show showed up on broadcast, the number of people who came back and watched it on their website had jumped by 44 times.
Amazing!
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So the thing is,
that's exactly my point, right? But you accidentally stumble across something,
but the point
and
is,
then you
is
get
that,
excited about it.
But the
it,
thing
right?
is that as we start seeing that, as we cross, and there's two directions that this happens: that we're crossing from online to broadcast or cable, but cable is also, as they are adding more and more content, as the Travel Channel adds more content on the web, and people get better. Oh, people who are into travel, and as Discovery Channel is always pushing people towards their web page, people are getting more and more savvy about, oh, I can go to these things and find more information.
Right. So the thing that we have to do, though, I'm sorry, the thing that we have to do is we have to understand that the quality of the product that we're producing, even though we may think it's good as a podcaster or a videocaster or what have you, the quality that we have to match for television, for the television standard, is pretty high.
Well,
the production value.
Well, fortunately.
I mean, the quality of the show and the script and all that aside, I mean, there's a certain amount of camera work, there's a certain production value, there's a certain amount that goes into a television show that we may not realize is there. And I think that's why a lot of these things aren't ready to cross over.
Well,
right,
I think that we have to see that. I mean, that the... but I think that we can serve niches. You know, I don't think we have to reach television quality.
Right.
I mean, when we look at, many of our shows are as good as MTV was when it launched. If you go back and look at those videos,
but look how many years ago that was.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that they started there.
I'm not sure I would aspire to that, Alex.
I'm not. What I'm saying is I'm not aspiring to look like MTV was in 1983. What I'm talking about is that cable didn't start out. If you look at, I mean, the one of the most amazing, for me, one of the most amazing transitions for a network is Discovery. If you look at the crap that they put on the air in the early 90s and the low production values, but people kept on people like me watched it day in, day out, because it was the only place that I could acquire information.
There was something.
So anyway, so we watched it,
and you think that's going to repeat? You think we're willing to watch crap again?
Oh no, I think we are watching crap.
I'm not sure though, because of the amount of information available to us. I'm not sure we are willing to sit through crap again.
There are, you know, I mean, the
cat videos.
If it's under 3 minutes long,
there are podcasts that I do that I would consider very rough. In fact, I would say most of the podcasts that I do, I would consider very rough. Around the corners, low production values from my standards, you know, things that when I watch, I still cringe. Okay, but there are 40,000 people listening to it, you know, watching it, you know, or 50,000 people watching it, and it still makes me go, you know, and I, we can make it better, you know, and so the thing is that, but as we start closing that gap, and a lot of it, the difference is that we can close those gaps. When you look at like an HV20, you know, or an HV30 now, did you guys get an HV30?
Yeah, we went out and spent this week shopping for cameras.
You didn't get the HV30 yet?
No, I'm sorry. I haven't yet. But
I expect one on Friday because we're going to show you how to...
Yeah, we'll talk about that afterwards.
All right. So anyway, if you look at the HV30, if you light something well and you wire it, you know, correctly from your camera, you will get footage that is you could get footage out of that camera that is indistinguishable from TV. Now, the key is you got to get the other side of it, what's in front of the camera. You got to get, and we're learning that. I mean, as I think if you look at some of the earlier versions of, you know, TWiM or MacBreak or whatever, you know, we're learning how much production, how much preparation, how much all these things have to, you know, require to put together a show that's actually listenable, you know, and or watchable, you know, and that's something that I think people vastly underestimate. They don't realize that the crazy, stupid reality show that they're watching has a budget of $1 million a show.
Right. Or Quarter Life, which looked like it had the budget of $5, you know, had $1 million budget and just grips everywhere and things like that. I mean, that was a failure. And it was not a failure because of the production quality,
right,
which was arguably bad. It was, right, you know, it was the story and all those things just didn't make sense.
But I think that a lot of us are, when you look
which
at a lot of magazines,
story's important.
I just want to
story's everything.
Okay, so I have to go back like 10 minutes because Alex has been talking. I just want to say that it's possible for a show to be found serendipitously without looking. So my show, Beer School, and I'm going to use this as my own example, is that people search for beer on iTunes, and my show comes up as the number one show about beer.
And nice. the next word for almost all of them is dude.
And this is you know, Real Big Fish. This is some other bands that have a song about beer, and then it's us. And so I get hundreds of emails in the last year that have said, I love your show. I found it on iTunes.
Right. I wasn't arguing, and I apologize if I made it sound this way, I wasn't arguing that you couldn't serendipitously find it. I was arguing that the size of the audience who is willing to participate in that act is very, very small. I don't know what the audience of Beer School is.
I can't tell you.
But I'm suspecting it is in the tens of thousands, because I think the audience who will serendipitously find
But the question is
really, really small compared to the audience who would find, you know, Private Practice, which is bizarre.
But it's already bigger. But my little show about photography, or our little show about photography, This Week in Photography,
yeah,
already has a larger listenership than about 80% of the radio stations in the United States.
We
want to invert this. When we talk about advertising and everything else, we have to remember that local media, you know, we can talk about this mass media, but when we talk about local media, the big advantage that, you know, these are radio stations that have a lot more overhead than This Week in Photography or and This Week in Photography happens to be the example, because I was amazed that we went from
really small
from
potential
to
audience
larger,
though, for radio stations. Right, really small potential audience, because it's such a geographically
That's the problem.
Exactly.
But they have built an entire business for a century or nearly a century around
10 years.
What?
Or 10 years? Look at Live 105. It's only been around since the 80s.
Right. And so, I mean, what I mean is the industry has built this business around the niche that they were serving was the people in Butler, Pennsylvania.
You said Pennsylvania.
I did. But Butler, Pennsylvania, you know, has a population of 35,000. There's two radio stations that serve it, and they have a whole business that runs all of that. You know, and so the thing is that they built a business around it, and we have, like, for instance, This Week in Photography, as an example, becomes cash positive next month.
Yep.
Six weeks or eight weeks after we launched.
I think that's amazing.
You know,
and so
the thing is that that's what's happening now. And the thing is that we don't need a million viewers.
Right.
I mean, if we look at the CPM of this stuff, let's say we never get a podcast that ever has more than 200,000 listeners, and let's say we could extrapolate at some point in time that we could get a higher CPM because it's a high quality audience in that niche. Let's say we can get up to $50 CPM. That means we're making $10,000, you know, per show. I think I'm doing my math correctly, but I think we're doing $10,000 per show at $50 CPM. That's a lot more than we're making on the shows that we're making now. You know, and the thing is that's a viable business. If I can make the show for $8,000 and make $10,000 on it, then I have a bunch of shows. This turns into a real business, and it doesn't ever have to get any bigger. But this gets into the piranha issue, which is that if there's, you know, a million of shows like us that only have 200,000 viewers. Now, it doesn't get into it if these are the only people, but if you suddenly have a lot of different cycles, you know, going into this, then who's watching TV?
Right. You still also have to convince the advertisers that your 200,000 people or 100,000 people or 10,000 people are worth their time. And
well, and what's
and
been,
that's
what's,
still the problem.
What's happening, right, though, is that when you look at, and one of the trailblazers that's really helping us is Leo.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
Leo,
you have a very, very fortunate position, right, where you have a kind of convergence between a lot of different podcasts that you've mm-hmm. worked on and been a pioneer right. for. And a lot, I mean, I wonder how, if TWIP were launched by someone who's not you and not Scott Bourne and not you guys, you know, I wonder,
no, it would have done as well.
Would it even have been found?
No, no. I would say it took 3 to 4 years
yeah, exactly.
of work to get to a point where we could launch a show that went like that.
Right.
You know, that went up. And that's the reality. It's not, it isn't, we get back into the bands and everything else. It does take
right.
hard work.
It takes work.
Huh?
It takes persistence. You right. know, we've done a lot of shows for a long time. They sometimes have advertising, sometimes don't. I mean, this show, you know, sometimes has sponsors, sometimes doesn't.
They should give us cameras.
It's like Jonathan Colton, right? Everyone calls him runaway success, but it was how many years of really hard work? I mean, there are at least 3 years of a song a week that I know of mm-hmm. before.
No, there's one year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I think he did it in 2006, but
a
no, but
a week
you're right.
Was 1 year.
Yeah. It was 2006 when he did Thing a Week. Still, I mean, that was, he wrote a song every week for a year that creatively,
that's a lot
I mean,
of work.
As a writer, I have to say that's some serious output.
Not,
I mean, it's
not
draining,
just writing,
right?
It's music.
I mean, that is like creatively, yeah. emotionally exhausting, and
but when
tactic,
I guess when did he quit
stuff.
His job? It was 2000
somewhere
was,
around that.
Yeah, it was right around 2005, 2006. Oh, but yeah. you know, I mean, to that end, John, I think you're right. I'm sure. Probably in 2005, there was planning and there's preparation, you know. But it's just, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about launching a new web show, and I think, I have two kids and I've got a job and I'm trying to write mm-hmm. novels. Why the heck am I thinking about launching another web show? Because I have to develop the whole community. I mean, I can see what I need to do to make it successful and the blogs
but
and the other
but,
sites
but,
to see it. So it's so much work.
But part of it, but part of
no,
it,
right?
It's a lot of work.
But part of what makes it work is what you're doing here. You're yeah. on another show. You know, and what's made our show successful is that I used to be on TWIT, and then I'm still mm-hmm. on MacBreak Weekly, and then I'm still on, you know, in all those other shows that I put all that time into. And I think that if you're useful at what you do, if you're actually interesting to listen to or look at or whatever while you're talking, people will want to have you on the show. You know, and the thing is that, and you need to find how to, you know, we need to find ways to, you know, get on those other things, you know, cross-pollinate between each other. Now, it doesn't get over what John Flowers is talking about, because it still means that we're all inside the same
echo chamber.
We're still all in what you were talking about. Is
except
we're not,
for but, me. I'm not in that echo chamber.
But if we are the, not me personally, but I'm saying the collective that is the echo chamber, if that's the group of people who, you know, have the most disposable income and are the most willing to spend it on advertising for these shows, and they're the most willing to listen to these shows, maybe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It actually is, though, because
the question is the key is, can you get to the inside track so that when things are more available, mm-hmm. you have access to it?
Well, the right. thing also, though, is if it is an overlap between all those different audiences, there's only a finite amount of advertising money that's going to go out to it. I mean, advertisers are not going to want to advertise to the same person over and over and over again. And they do have ways of tracking and seeing right. that is, in fact, happening. So in reality, there's a finite amount of money for a finite amount of unique users out there. But I think also that at the same time, we're just in the early days of this type of content. And really, we've seen a trend over the last, oh, probably 10 years or so, 15 years, of originally you had mostly network TV. You had a very close, confined, walled garden of viewers, and the content was put out by the networks. And then you had the writer's strike, and then you had cable television really coming into its own, and people started moving out into cable television, and it got more fragmented and less controlled. And now we're having online content come out, and it's getting yet more fragmented, and people have more choices. And I think it's just going to be that progression from very captive audience to less captive and with more choices and more programming options.
Well, and we've seen this. I mean, when radio came out, you know, mm-hmm. my grandfather picked up the first commercial radio station in Pittsburgh, you know, KDKA, and their first commercial broadcast. He had to build a crystal radio set from scratch.
Sweet.
When he was like 9 years old, he had like built this thing so he could pick up the radio broadcast. But he was a geek, you know, and he was a geek. I mean, for the time that I remember him, you know, in most of my childhood up until my early 20s, you know, before he passed away, he was always a geek. He was still soldering, you know, because he built like every piece of radio equipment that he had in the house, he built. And these guys were the same thing, radio, and that's never going to go anywhere. Or they thought that, I mean, the telephone was supposed to be there to broadcast shows. Like, no one's ever going to use it for, you know, who would ever want to talk to each other? You know, and so the thing is that it all started out with us being geeks, you know, or people being geeks about it and figuring out how to play with it, this newfangled device. And then it always ends up, you know, if it is viable, you know, the masses end up, you know, imbibing it because that's what they do. And now, speaking of all of that, one of the things that's going to make it easier, we got a couple tech things here. First of all, Verizon is getting cozy with this. The PDP. John, I figured John Foster wants to talk about this. He might want to say, well, I think John's big comment is, I told
everyone this. So. Yes. 2000s, we figured this out.
We talked this over and over again. John and I sat there talking about this stuff, and we drew it up on the board before, yeah, you know, before BitTorrent, before all this stuff, and we were like, well, then there's no way you could actually make this work if you didn't have the ISPs.
You've got to have the ISPs, and the idea is that if you can keep the bits inside the network, you get those bits for free. You get them as fast as possible, and you don't have to pay for them. You don't have to pay for them going in. You don't have to pay
for Verizon proposing?
Proposing that they want to help the torrent traffic, the P2P traffic, for legitimate things like movies, music, that kind of stuff, where there's actually money being paid for this.
Subscribers wouldn't have to go outside the Verizon network.
Yeah, and the idea is that if you have a bunch of people that are all trying to download the same television show, it's not really television anymore, but the same show or the same music or the same whatever, it doesn't pay to have those bits leaving your network and coming into your network every single time a user's trying to get that. Hmm. It makes sense to keep those bits inside. And so if, in fact, they're so smart that they say, okay, well, we're going to put a server that's handling these files as they're coming in, and we'll serve them within our network to preserve our bandwidth coming in and out, then this helps us.
And it helps everyone. It helps everyone. It helps the backbone. It helps the interconnection between all of the, you know, it helps everybody.
The user experience goes up, their costs go down, and everybody's happy.
And you know, at the conference in New York, and this is according to biz.yahoo.com, at a conference in New York, the Verizon Group will present test results showing that when an ISP cooperates with the file sharing software maker, they can speed downloads an average of 60%, though collaboration boosted some downloads to sixfold on fast internet connections.
Right. So this is where this is a problem, is that if you have a DSL connection, it's going to max out at some number like 150K a second or 300K a second, and that's as fast as it's going to go. So the quote about speeding up downloads is kind of bogus, because if it's already going at its max, then it can't.
Yeah, but how many times do we – when we're downloading a torrent, how many times are we maxing out?
Pretty much depending on what,
what
the torrent is. I know that something I was recently downloading took 4.5 days to download because there wasn't enough seeds. Right. Now,
or you were on Comcast.
No, it was. It's not a Comcast network. But the idea is that if this technology was in place, instead of taking 4 days to download, it would have taken 25 minutes, like it should have.
It's really fascinating that I download something from iTunes and it's, I don't know, 7 to 50 times faster than downloading it from a comparable size file from a torrent site.
Well, so the difference
because that's what Akamai is doing in a lot of ways.
So what's happening is when you're downloading from iTunes, you have a connection to a server and it's going to flood your connection. And this is what Verizon's trying to eliminate, is this flooded connection between you and that remote server.
Right. They just put that upstream connection local.
Closer.
Right.
Right. So instead of...
So they're not paying... They're also not paying to cross over to another...
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's smart.
So it becomes cheaper for the ISP to do it.
So instead of your pipe going through May West or May East, you know, and paying for that expensive connection, it's not doing that. It's staying in the network.
This is what a lot of people have been promising for a long time. You look at organizations like CashFly or Akamai or these kind of guys. This is what they have been doing. They just haven't been doing it at the ISP level.
Well, so this is what corporate guys are doing. So a lot of people, there's no way that their server can stay or their connection can keep up with everybody. So they put a SQUID server between the inside and the outside connection, so that when everybody's going to get their CNN or their ESPN or their other PN stuff or their NN or whatever, it's grabbing it from the cache. And so that way that content is always going to, it may be behind by 5 minutes, but who cares? You've got 100 guys that are all looking at the same thing.
Wow. Speaking of technology, I don't, how savvy is our audience? We just said squid server. And
The thing is we don't want to talk down to people. We just you know, every once in a while we're gonna shoot over people's heads.
What is a squid server?
So a squid server is basically a caching server. It's okay. An open source project that basically remembers stuff as it's coming in.
Okay.
And the BOFH can set it to time to die. So this link may only last for 5 minutes before it's allowed to refresh itself.
Okay. You know, it's interesting, really quick on this story too, just hearing the technical angle of it. It's interesting because I saw a completely different angle I thought was brilliant about it, which is that so Verizon is getting very cozy with P2P and making their network appear very open at a time when Comcast is doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, so it's good PR for Verizon's
coming in here with their Fios, which is kind of their bundled, you know, high speed internet and their cable and everything else, and they're competing against Comcast on that.
Right. But Fios doesn't work unless you have something like this. Because if you have, let's say your last mile goes 100 megabits, but your little pipe on the other side only goes whatever.
Well, the
it
big thing is
work.
That is that Fios can work with this, whereas Comcast with their legacy cable type architecture really can't do it. So it's really making
this is
things.
A very Fios becomes extremely efficient,
right?
Maybe high speed connections with everybody.
I mean,
and they're passing stuff around.
But see,
at a time when Comcast is getting dinged for basically filtering stuff without telling people and basically doing everything they can to limit.
But
their
Verizon is getting to subtly push back the unofficial content. So the thing is, they're saying, "Oh yeah, we're working with P2P, but they're
looking
not working
open
with,
and, you know, at the same time.
And but they're not working with Demonoid or any of these P2P guys, right?"
Yeah, exactly.
I thought it was just a really brilliant kind of PR that they did.
Well, the other thing with cable is that it's specifically throttled back to handle the weakest link, which is the incoming and outgoing pipe.
Yeah.
So because of the way that that cable works, it's essentially an Ethernet network that's been transceivered up, and I'm grossly simplifying this because I don't want to explain, but you can go really fast within that network, basically 10 base T speed.
Now, isn't it heavily asymmetric, though, towards download?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's just like any other Ethernet network.
Yeah, so if people suddenly start uploading things into the network, then it really slows everything down, right?
No, that's generally not the issue.
Okay.
Also in the technology area, IMAX theaters are going to ditch film. They're going to use digital DLP projectors. I actually was kind of excited about this. I'm just hoping they can actually get the audio synced up. Because every time I go, it's two frames off.
I'm sure they'll figure it out.
This seems like this
That's
would correct that problem.
Yeah.
At least they could adjust it. At least they could adjust it. I'm sitting there every time I go to an IMAX. It's all I go to. I just want to see how things on IMAX. I just want it to not be 2 frames
now,
off.
Now, does this mean I'm going to see those little rainbow things in 3D now?
Or I was thinking the same thing.
Those drive me nuts.
Yeah. Although a lot of new DLP projectors, if people don't know what we're talking about, there's a color wheel that spins different colors and digital DLP, digital light projection. A lot of people can see what looks like a rainbow pattern of picket fences going by. Like if you were driving really fast in a car and looked out the window, you would see a colorful array of picket fence. And
a
lot of people see that in DLP.
I'm sure that given the frame rate that IMAX wants to run, which is faster than 24, that they have to deal with that issue.
I mean, when you see that, I mean, there's so many opportunities. And it's nice to have IMAX, which is kind of more centralized, able to just decide. I just love the idea that we're just going to go to digital projection. Well, what they're actually doing now is they're shipping
all... No DCI, no nothing. We're just
they're
going.
Shipping, well, they're shipping... They're going to ship all the new projectors with the digital so that you can switch back and forth. So they're not just overturning all the stuff that already exists right now, but they're going to make that available. But it is going to... Now, the big thing is how do you acquire information... How do you acquire IMAX information digitally? So they're going to still grab it all in film, but the distribution obviously changes the price. I mean, the IMAX, if you've never seen an IMAX film, you know, it's like 4 times the size of 35 millimeter. It is so expensive to move the IMAX. I mean, it's literally like I'm making it so everyone can see it.
It's a 70 millimeter frame.
So it's this huge frame. And very, very expensive. So this is going to pay off, I think, almost immediately for IMAX. But it also means that as we start moving into the digital era, just like with cameras right now, moving away from what was even possible. You know, when we talk about 1,000 frame per second cameras or 10,000 frame per second cameras, I mean, those didn't exist in the film world. I think we're going to get to a point where does IMAX go from 24p to 60p?
I mean, I hope not. Because I think when you walk outside of 24p, I think you kind of lose the magic of film.
Well, I mean, I disagree.
But the question is do you care? Do you care when you're okay? Yes, when I'm telling The Matrix, or I'm telling Constantine, or I can think of another Keanu Reeves one. Maybe you're right, but if I'm watching a film about whales
or U2 3D in concert
or whatever, you know, an IMAX window at 60 frames a second, which I guess and you would probably know more than I would, Kirsten. I believe that they said that the theoretical refresh rate of a human eye is about 60 frames a second, or somewhere in that.
It is around that, yeah.
It's somewhere in that ballpark. If you go much over that, you get to the point where we wouldn't be able to perceive it. If you're talking about a digital projection,
it's flicker fusion frequency.
Yeah, so
flicker fusion frequency.
So as we go over that, and as we go into a true IMAX, you know, experience. At that rate, does it turn into something that looks like a window?
Just like a big window into reality.
But a big window, and that changes. I think that's just an entirely different.
But the IMAX experience has done this. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they had what's the pyramid in Las Vegas?
The Luxor.
They had a film that was based on IMAX-like technology, which Trumbull did, and it ran at faster than 30 frames a second. I think it was 48, maybe 50 frames, and it looked like a window. It was an incredible experience.
Yeah. So
when you see,
I remember that it's like there's a ride and there's like a pharaoh and find some weird lost ark.
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly. And the experience was surreal because you're looking at this going, why does that look like it's there?
Yeah. Why is there something slightly not?
No, it looked
otherworldly about this. It looks very real, yeah.
No, it looks very real. And so when you see this, you're like, wow, that's what film can do? Not this little stuttery thing where I can see the frames and the stepping and all the other crap that goes with film.
If I want to tell a story, I get you into the mode of 24 frames a second, I tell you that. But how scary does a thriller get when you feel like you're looking through a window?
Or Cloverfield. Cloverfield is the perfect example
or Blair Witch Project.
Of a film that, yeah. If Cloverfield had been
60 frames a second, 60 frames a second,
it would have been, yeah. That would have been staggering.
Even that more kind people of would film. Have been throwing up.
finally, we had the last technology piece here. This was on a blog, a Jamie G analysis of now we have tapeless workflows. We still need tapes.
Can we skip this and talk about ProRes going pro or no?
Let's talk about
that article's not deep enough.
Let's talk about this for 1 minute, okay?
I just want to talk about this for one minute. Here's the thing: is that I think it's wrong. So that's what I'm going to say right now. As someone who has to deal with this all day, you know, the thing is,
you think tapeless workflow?
We are tapeless. In fact, right now we're getting rid of all of our tape. There will be no more tape here in the next 3 months.
So Jamie G analysis says now we have tapeless workflows, but we still need tapes,
and we don't need tapes.
Okay.
And the thing is that his option was that, but I think it's an interesting thing because people ask us constantly. We have an F950, we're shooting 180 megs a second. Even with our EX, we shoot 160 megs a second. People are asking, like, what do you do with all the data?
Well, he suggests you could go tape or you could go Blu-ray,
which would be insanely expensive. Mm-hmm. It would be insanely expensive and in both money and time. You know, and the only reason I brought this up was because specifically the issue is a lot of people ask us how you're dealing with it, and how we're dealing with mm-hmm. it is we have a lot of hard drives.
That's how everyone is dealing with it.
Yeah, and what
That's
I found out by the way,
to
Weebatech,
deal with that quantity of
Weebatech.
Data.
Makes little cases for your little hard drives.
But what
They're
about
so cute.
The
they look like tape cases. Like you have instead of SR or HD cam or whatever, you just have drive cases.
Right.
It's beautiful.
But what are you doing about the deterioration of the digital data. I mean, to date, tape still is the most
But we've lost so much data on tape.
You're going to lose it no matter what, but I'm just...
Is tape more reliable than a hard drive?
I don't think so.
Well,
I don't know, that's what I've read.
Okay, so
people looking at stuff and actually doing like comparative studies, they've actually seen that tape
lasts longer. Here's the study. Tape lasts a really long time, whereas hard drives, if you take a hard, and I've said this before,
if you don't spin the hard drive, you got to spin it.
The rate of the failure of the hard drive is it's going to fail at 25% per the year that it hasn't been spun.
Right. Oh. So you got to keep them spinning.
You got to keep them spinning. So
you spin it every 6 months.
No. So the solution then is just a big fatty fat Drobo-like cloud, like you were talking about.
Well, and I think the future is...
We just cram drives into it.
Right, well,
and a nice intern who can do it for
you. Well, yeah, and the other thing is that what we're really looking at is the future of ZFS, you know, which is... And there's a whole MacBreak tech
about ZFS. It's called Zulu Foxtrot Sierra.
Yeah, and the thing is the ZFS is the idea of a... I mean, I think where we're going... And right now, as I said, we use drives. We have very low failure rates, but we double up. The important stuff is on two different drives.
Right.
The chances of both drives going is very low.
So, right.
But they're raw drives. We pay $112 for 500 gigs from Amazon. You know, and we pop the little Weebitech little converter on them, and we just pull the data, you know, put the data on and off. The great thing is that when it's backed up, you know, we use this stupid program, which we're going to eventually rewrite ourselves just because it is so freaking slow. But it's called Disk Tracker. And I will admit the reason it's so slow is because we have 120 500 gig drives databased into it. So it's a 300 meg file of text, you know, that's just where all our stuff is. But literally, I needed to find an aperture. I needed to find one little file that I needed that was related to aperture that I haven't seen for a year and a half. And do you know how long it took me to acquire that file?
Longer than it took you to load the data.
6 minutes. For me, from
the
time.
To find it.
Or
to have it on your system.
To have it on my system. Yeah. Because I went to the database, I went...
But Alex, you could totally do that with tape and Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Obviously, you know, anybody who believes that has obviously never used DLT and never tried to find something on a DVD.
You know, like a paper ledger, too.
And part of it is having so much data on one drive.
System.
So much data on one drive. I mean, you know, one of those drives at $112 is 10, at least 10 Blu-rays at $50 each. You know, so the thing is that I can't even touch tape. I mean, you know, as far as like DLTs or anything else, it is just totally worthless. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, we've had so many failure issues and so many with DAT tapes and DLTs and all this other stuff. And the other thing is that I value my time, which means that I'll never use a tape.
The problem is that clients bring you tapes, and this is the issue.
So you ingest them and put them on hard drives.
Yeah, exactly.
And then give them the tapes back.
Right. And so the project that I did a year ago for the big toy company lives on hard drives that are constantly being spun and you know, moved from drive to drive because to make sure that the data is still there. And those tapes, that huge library of stuff, I don't need it anymore. So when they call me up and go, hey, can you make us this? I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem.
Right.
It's done.
I just think that this is such a huge opportunity for someone like Data Robotics, who does Drobo, to come in and fill, you know, an
huge
empty market
gap.
Space.
Well, it needs to be inexpensive.
What's funny is it's a market that already exists in this like ghetto fabulous way where we're all stringing this stuff together. But it's a market that's not.
No, I mean, I will say that
150
drives. I will say that right now it's a transient market because, as I said, I think that as ZFS, and it's a valuable market, and someone could make a lot of money on it right now. But what I'm saying is that as we move to ZFS, and I think that ZFS is something that is going to happen.
Right.
ZFS is like RAID 5 on steroids.
Right.
You know, so basically, what it means is that I have a data cloud. So I have.
But where do you put those drives in ZFS?
In the closet, somewhere else. You know,
right. But I mean, what do you connect them to? What I'm saying is there still needs to be a mechanism by which to connect these drives.
Absolutely.
That's why I'm saying.
Here's the thing. Gigabit Ethernet, You could plug in directly if you needed to. There's a lot of
and
ways.
And eventually you need to build a something that'll hold them all. And I agree with that. But the main thing is that what you end up with is a cloud of data, and as drives fail, you just put new drives in, but none of the data is lost. You know, you just keep on adding more drives to it. And the great thing about it is as we follow Moore's Law as it applies to storage, what you end up with is that the storage that I can buy today is, you know, twice as big as the storage I had, whatever, last year. Last week for the same price. And so the idea is that you just keep on moving the storage forward, and I think we're probably in the last decade of moving media.
That's right, not true. No, it's going to continue to be.
You really think so?
I think so. Yeah, because
not the solid state.
No, the solid state's very expensive, and while it is,
I'm saying 10 years, well, not in the last year.
But here's big disks will continue no matter what because they can continue to make those drives
bigger than solid state.
Yeah, bigger than solid state. Bigger, faster, cheaper, and that's what that becomes. Especially once the patent issues of ZFS are resolved between the two people that are duking it out right now. Once that's resolved, then two things happen. One of them is that spinning disks become more valuable because now you don't have to worry about them failing.
Right.
The irony of this is what you really need is you need two data centers at separate locations that you can connect to on the over the internet at some high-speed way.
I mean, that's what I'm building right now.
Redundant, blah, blah, blah. Well, I mean, it's just...
What I'm building right now is it's very small. It's just a test. But a 2-gig, you know, a 2-gig, and it might be a Drobo, but a 2-gig RAID here, RAID 5 here, and a 2-gig RAID 5 at my house. And the idea is that they are sync every night. And so the thing is anything I work on here moves over there, and anything I work over there moves over here. You know, and my computer doesn't have any data.
Oh yeah, I guess what I was saying is you need something where there's no rsync involved. It's just disks in separate locations.
But I would say that's a very basic experiment with something that you get to a point where you have these data sets that are and it would be very trivial. To build something that would automatically have two drives that just constantly meld each other, meld back and forth no matter what I'm using. They constantly go, that's a newer file. I should move that over here. I should do this. I mean, the big thing is just how you deal with delta changes. And that's as soon as you figure that out, I think that you get to a point where you do have it's very easy to have two different areas where you're just working in the cloud.
Right. I use something called Jungle Disk for the Mac, which is it connects to Amazon's S3 to back up. Lots of data.
And online?
Yeah,
I'm not a big fan of that. Yet.
I know, it's a big pain.
It's scary.
However, it's Amazon and it's totally usable, and I only get charged for putting it up, the bandwidth to put it up, and then the cost of having it there. And it seems like it's certainly more expensive than your solution, but I never have to worry about offsite backups things. That's but right. It's not – what you're suggesting, and I think what we're all talking about, is something that is much more easily accessible in a very quick way.
Yeah,
and – you know, there's just nothing out there.
I'm just waiting
other
for
than a bunch of hard drives.
Quantum computer.
I
want 3D data storage.
Yeah, Warren promised some kind of holographic 3D optical storage and flying cars. Flying cars and holographic storage. I was promised these two things.
John, where can people find you?
Well, I've been talking about beerschool.com for all night, so that's where you can find me.
Beerschool.com.
Beerschool.com, number one podcast about beer on iTunes.
Sweet.
Kirsten.
You can find me at kirstensanford.com, my blog, The Bird's Brain, thisweekinscience.com, twist.org, and revision3/popsiren.
Okay. Marshall.
Yep. You can find me at marshallclark.net, and I guess I can tell people now that I work with Organic. I'm a director of search there for the San Francisco office.
Oh, cool!
Excellent. We weren't sure if we should say anything yet, so we had him in
no
last
more
week
super ago. Secret mysterious. Yeah,
nice. for a large advertising.
Ooh, yeah. One of my best friends in the world, Danica Remy, used to work at Organic, and she had the coolest title ever in the late 90s. Early 2000s, which was Chief Collaboration Officer.
Ooh,
and I always
nice.
Thought, right on, Organic.
John Flowers, where can people find you?
Probably the best place is lifezero.org.
And Daisy?
Well, I write for TVWeek.com on a daily basis, and you can also find me at DaisyWhitney.com, where you will find my weekly episodes of the New Media Minute.
Soon to have animated backgrounds.
Yeah, and all sorts of other cool stuff.
Yeah, definitely check that out.
Yeah. Speaking of animated backgrounds, you guys need an exit song for TWIP. You should ask, this is This Week in Media. We should have a media person help produce
we actually have more data. We have more data than we're using for TWIP here.
Oh, I see.
So yeah,
it just sort of ends, and I'm like,
No. This will be our exit.
Yeah, we need to put
no,
Joe.
Our exit music is
Joe's
in
there like, okay.
John Cage, 4:33.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I just want to throw a little. I keep on wanting to just throw a little Psychosonic.
Well, it's doing so well. Maybe you should, use Jonathan Colton's "I Crush Everything" for TWIP.
Right. I bet you I can get some rights to Nine Inch Nails. this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.
Last week it was a message. This week it's a mess.
It's a big brainstorm.
It's really funny. The after show last week, people were stoked about it.
Really?
It's really interesting. Yeah, it was just stories of, my fiance being upset about popcorn. Kirsten,
by the way, did I tell you? I meant to talk about during the show that I'm trying to get everyone to play Marathon with me, and no one will play.
No one will play with you.
No. So what happened was I told the Pixel Core. I was like, so everyone download Marathon and we'll play it at noon on Monday. I sent this email out to everyone, and I got there on noon, and there was no one there.
And you're all out of the guild.
Yeah, like you're all fired. But hopefully people will be listening to this after show, and they'll download it. And now we actually Sosh.
Hint.
Sosh actually built an installer just for you.
Oh, really?
It's a DMG.
Oh, I like Shosh.
Yeah.
It's Shosh, right?
Shosh.
Yeah. I thought it was S-hash.
Yeah, S-hash. So, nice. So he built a DMG that'll just install Infinity with the Aleph, but it is fun. I have to admit, I have no idea who I'm playing with right now, but I just go and I go up there and there's people there and I kill them, and which is great. I love Carnage.
It's not someone younger than you then. If they're a 12-year-old, they'd kill you.
You know what's funny is I've realized
are amazing.
No, I've realized here's the distinction.
Maybe not at Marathon.
Here's the distinction is I haven't played for a decade, and they play every day, but they didn't play for an hour and a half. They didn't play for an hour and a half for 2 years straight.
That muscle memory is still there after all that.
What's funny?
It's just like riding a bike.
It was one of those things. Like I was like, this isn't working, and then suddenly I got all my keys back. I got hold on.
Alex
he's gotta,
is pulling
he's
something
go
out
find
of his bag.
Something.
Gamer pad.
I got a gamer pad. No. It's one of these.
It's a numeric keypad.
But this is the key to the. This and a mouse is the key to the operation.
Actually, I think
you're like ready to rock and roll, man.
No. See, what you need is a Nostromo N51. That would be even better.
And then you just start off.
Then
with,
you can have the hat switch, and then
All right, Alex, why don't you take your numeric pad and mouse and go play Counter Strike against 12-year-olds and see how
No. I like doing that. I don't play new games. I only play.
You
got to
pick
games.
The games that the young kids don't want to play. Otherwise, they'll kill you.
Yeah, it's funny. I was playing Halo 3 against someone who was like 16, and they just. Banked me. But we put in Halo 1, I owned them. It was brutal. It was like I had the pistol, I didn't care what they were carrying around. I just pwned them from a distance.
Well,
it was brutal.
I have to say I was talking to someone in the Defense Department about and he was mentioning how efficient all of these games were for what they were doing, which is that he was talking about the future is not guys running around with guns, it's machines running around with guns and guys playing video games.
It's Ender's Game,
he said it's much easier to get someone who he said it hasn't happened yet, but he said that he can see that people playing games that are like flight sim combat games are going to be much more useful to him than actual pilots. Because they're used to seeing all that information
and not
virtually.
Freaking out at all.
Well, and not being upset that their manlihood is being attacked and that they're no longer in the plane and they're all this other stuff. And so he said we're not going to use pilots from he said the F-35 and I think the F-22 or whatever, those are the last manned planes ever going to that are ever going to be used in the fighter
plane. The plane can kill the guy inside.
Right.
We need twitchy robots with high visual acuity.
well, what, what he said is that the dexterity that you're getting out of kids playing this over and over and over again is much higher than the average person. You know, being able to manage a lot of oftentimes basic information, less useful information than we're used to, and being able to make a decision about what that is very, very quickly. And act on it is going to be a really, you know, that's the future.
Just reminds me of Ender's Game.
That's what that's what I was just saying. Yeah, exactly. It feels very Ender's Game.
It's funny too, and I say funny. I mean, funny
Banks
kind of in a sick way.
Funny, but, strange, not funny. Huh?
Funny, like kind of gross. But the I think it was the Army made an actual first person shooter.
Yeah.
That they're using for recruiting. I think it was called America's Troops. Something like that.
It's actually pretty successful.
Yeah, pretty successful. I mean, it's pretty you know, low tech game compared to a lot of the other ones that are out there. But they actually built it specifically. Recruiting, which I thought was pretty.
Well, not only that, if I remember correctly, they built it to train their own troops as well.
Ooh, and that's right.
They actually used it because they needed the engine built. And so what they did is provide they provided technical information to the game company to make it very, very accurate.
Yeah.
And what they got was a game that they, because I mean, it was like when I had this meeting with, and I showed photogrammetry. And they were like, you know, of course, the question that came right after photogrammetry, you know, you take a couple photos and you can build a 3D model out of it, kind of like Google Earth or whatever, like two or three photos, and you can build these 3D models out of it. And the next thing that came up was, now, can you get that into the Doom engine? Because what we want is we want our special ops to be able to come around a corner and know what they're going to see next, and know when they're sitting in a street what street it is, by playing Doom in San Francisco or Baghdad or whatever over and over and over again, so that the streets look familiar.
Recognize it.
So they're not just lost and don't know which way to go.
You know, you reminded me of just one thing when you start saying that too. Made it even creepier about the Army first person shooter game is they actually had soldiers. They gave them time and machines to play the game on, and it's all a networked game. So they're actually soldiers playing with younger kids who may be up for enlisting, and talking to these guys and getting to know them. I just, the whole thing kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I thought it was very strange.
Okay,
and kind of creepy.
I have to go home and take cough medicine, so who wants to walk me to my car so I don't get killed by shooters or muggers or anything? And I do want to talk to you for one second.
What?
It's been rolling this whole time.
I know, turn it off.